The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so, of course. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
U zgradu I on došao posle meni se žalio da udario mi sve na dujem bio.
Ja nikada u životu klavu boju nisam voleo, kao klinac mrzeo pandure, nisam ih sve bojao.
This week on The Final Straw, we are talking to a member of Koko Lepo, which is an autonomous youth collective in Belgrade, Serbia. In this interview, we speak about how Koko Lepo got off the ground, about the political situation in Belgrade for anarchists, and about the nature of solidarity. If you'd like to write to Koko Lepo, you can do so by emailing them at kokolepo@riseup.net or searching Koko Lepo AV on Facebook. That's KOKOLEPO. But first, here's an announcement that came to us this morning from our comrades in Czech Republic. Quote, on Friday, the 27th of May, in Pankrák Remand prison, anarchist Martin Ignáček, accused of terrorism, went on a hunger strike. He did this because on April 29th, 2016, the city court in Prague ruled in favor of his release from remand, and the state's attorney appealed this decision to the High Court in Prague. On Friday, May 27th, the High Court in Prague extended the remand. Therefore, the anarchist has decided to protest by going on hunger strike and has stopped taking in nutrition and liquids. This type of hunger strike threatens the life of the hunger striker after 1 week only. Martin has been prosecuted in the so-called Phoenix case since April 2015, in which five people altogether were accused of the preparation and the failure to notify of a terrorist attack on a train. Martin is the only one who has been in remand prison this whole time, and his detention has now been extended after the intervention of the state's attorney. As a reason for the extension of remand, the state's attorney has used the testimony of a police agent who infiltrated the anarchist movement in 2014. From his testimony, the state's attorney drew the conclusion that Martin might attempt to escape to Spain. Another reason, according to him, was that Martin is connected in the so-called Network of Revolutionary Cells, or SRB, and therefore also to similar organizations abroad, end quote. The police spoke about the SRB when they began Phoenix and provided information to the media. Any connections between the five attacks ascribed to the SRB and all the detained and accused have been refuted. The investigators themselves have also ruled it out, says Martin. At the moment, Martin is the second longest detained prisoner in the Pankrák Remand prison. For 13 months, he has been living there under conditions that negatively affect his psychological and physical state. For example, he has been refused food free of animal products. Martin is a vegan, which means he practically doesn't have access to hot food. Friends who have come to visit him have been mentioned by name in the indictment. Police from the Department for Combating Organized Crime have started to collect information on Martin's sister, only because she tries to support her brother in whichever way she can. For Martin, parole would mean that after 13 long months, he would again see his friends, family, nature, that he wouldn't be exposed to emotional deprivation and physical hardship. On Sunday, May 29th, Martin's sister, Pavla B., joined her brother in the protest, and this morning she has started a hunger strike herself as well. For more information on this topic, you can follow antiphoenix.noblogs.org. That's A-N-T-I-F-E-N-I-X. You can also go to thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and search Antiphoenix as well for interviews that we have done on this topic. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a wall. I'm back. Did you savage cannibal maniacs miss me? I bet you did. This is probably only temporary, so I got to make this count. Back in September, someone at the FBI learned how to read and found out I was running for president. He or she shared the news with everyone else at the fascist bozos of intimidation, and immediately panic spread. They got a hold of Trainwreck Trevor, who was their Ohio prison surrogate, and the baby oil application specialist at their office naked twister parties on Tuesdays. Trevor immediately flipped the switch on all of my communications mediums. Now I'm the only presidential candidate in history silenced by the FBI. You know what that means. It means the hierarch program is so unstable and so fragile that even its most ardent attack dogs recognize that if the zombies participating in this useless electoral process realized they had the chance to vote for me and scrap the whole system, they'd do it. They'd flush the whole thing like a goldfish. You know they would. So the FBI has done what hierarchs always do when confronted by better ideas that challenge the legitimacy of their delusion. They wrap the messenger in duct tape and toss him in the basement. It's what you got to do when you are morally and intellectually bankrupt. You know they are. Keep in mind I had a 2.2 grade point average in high school and had a job pumping gas when I got locked up. If I'm really a threat to civilization, then it's doomed anyway. Might as well tip this cow and move on. Silencing me has been a mixed bag, it seems. While they've excluded me from the radio show, which we all know is the 5 minutes when everyone takes a bathroom break anyway, some really fun stuff has developed. First, we've got Swain 2016 t-shirts available, and I think you can order them from seanswain.org. They come in three colors, black, Mars black, and Anarchy black. Apart from the fact that they have my ugly mug on them, I've got a face for radio, they're quite fashionable as well as flammable. So you can wear them while tipping over cop cars, or stuff them into the mouths of vodka bottles, light them, and give it a good heave. There's just so many uses for Swain 2016 t-shirts. Everyone on the planet seeking liberation should wear one, and then we'll eat everyone who isn't. Problem solved. Second, besides the fantastic t-shirts produced by PDX ABC, a more recent development. I smuggled out communications to supporters who shared my communique with Donald Trump's campaign. In it, I related how JWoww can't even get his cabinet member's home address off of blastblog.noblogs.org. So how can JWoww be trusted to defeat ISIS? The Trump campaign was all over it. They planned to use it. So JWoww, having pledged on Tuesday that he was in the race until the convention, suspended his campaign on Wednesday without an explanation. Now you know the whole scoop. I did that. And now there's a roster of JWoww's entire staff posted at prisoner support sites along with their office phone numbers and email addresses. Feel free to contact all 70 of them to tell them how you feel about them suspending my communications after they hear this and shut me down again. Anyone out there looking to help me get elected can start by getting some awesome endorsements. I don't mean endorsements by like the Chamber of Commerce or George Clooney. I mean endorsements from the Earth Liberation Front, the Cleveland Four, Marius Mason, Jeremy Hammond, Anonymous, and maybe even Blastblog. For fascists who torture people, these people sure get their feelings hurt easily. We can expect that I'll be silenced again any minute now. Imagine how they're going to feel when I get sworn in as president, with my right hand raised and my left one resting on a can of gasoline. Never forget, gas is cheap, matches are free. This is anarchist prisoner and presidential candidate Sean Swain, and I approve this message.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. thank you very much for coming on to The Final Straw. Would you introduce yourself first and say a bit about what you do?
Yeah, my name is Freddie. I'm originally from Texas. I've been living in Serbia for over 3 years now. And I am a member of the autonomous youth solidarity collective Koko Lepo in Belgrade.
Would you mind telling the listeners like what brought you to Belgrade?
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to university. I guess I'm still technically going to university in Budapest at Central European University, studying sociology and social anthropology. And I was making a project that had some connections to direct action and the practice of ethnography. And I gave a talk to that effect in Budapest, and some comrades who I hadn't yet met from Belgrade and Novi Sad were at this talk, and they invited me to Serbia to speak. And so I went around with them. I saw some interesting spaces. I found out that there's actually quite a lot happening quite close to where I was, in a totally different scene. And I moved into Serbia to sort of join that scene. And I've been there for, yeah, over 3 years.
Are you describing anarchist scenes or political scenes when you talk about scenes?
Yeah. The friends that I had made were and are anarchists. And one of them, for instance, was heading along with a couple other people a quite successful festival called the Zrenjanin Anti-Fascist Festival. And this had been going on for a number of years. Another was a German guy who was working at an anti-fascist space as well, with a strong focus on gender politics. And this place was in Novi Sad. So I sort of fell into this, we could call it like a general anti-fascist autonomous scene. But this, and you know, my friends there were initially anarchist. They eventually became involved in squatting, and I sort of fell into that scene. So yeah, anarchism, squatting for sure, autonomy in general, and anti-fascism, I guess, at the most general level.
So you mentioned Koko Lepo, and that is what you are on the topic that you're touring with right now.
Yeah.
Would you first describe Koko Lepo, and how did it begin, and what are
Absolutely.
Its main like objectives or concerns or stuff like that?
Koko Lepo is now an autonomous youth solidarity program. I say this because I lack any really better descriptor for it. At the moment, it works with children between the ages of 8 to their early teens. And what we do currently is we organize autonomously and increasingly collectively with the kids that we're working with in order to do events in the city, and now hopefully increasingly long-term projects. The kids that are our friends and our and the participants in this program mostly come from a semi-formal Roma gypsy settlement called The Dump in the middle of Belgrade. The Dump is as it sounds. It's some kind of, I think, semi-formal dumping space that's also inhabited by a couple construction firms. And from the 1970s, it sort of slowly became a settlement of mostly Roma. And in the 1990s, this expanded after the Kosovo Wars, where something like 80-85% of the Roma population of Kosovo was expelled for suspicion of collaborating with the Serbian state, and they also came to the Dump. So at the moment, I can't really give a population estimate. Some people say 2,000. I feel like that might be too much, but it's somewhere in there. Koko Lepo, though, began not as a youth program, but as a kindergarten. And the idea was that we could provide a free kindergarten in a free space, which at the time was the Enix Film Squat, particularly the anarchist info shop in the squat. And from this, even if we couldn't give like papers that said that you attended school, we could at least provide the skills that were essentially being denied by, you know, forces like structural racism and forces like economic ghettoization as well. Also very much a racialized thing. So it began as a kindergarten. Started with one family, grew into several families, and now the youth program, I want to say at the moment, covers most of the families in the settlement, as we now know it anyway. The kindergarten worked 5 days a week at first. We dropped it down to 3 because all of us also have jobs. There was no money involved except for the solidarity donations we received from anti-fascist and anarchist groups as well as interested individuals. And no official status, there was no connection to non-governmental organizations, no connection to the state nor firms. And this did quite well. I mean, a lot of my tour has been talking about the failures of this program, but the fact is, I think it's also important to look at it as something that is possible for anyone to get involved in, despite how we may stumble through with these things. We did end up with a surviving program that has grown, and to me, this is the essence of Koko Lepo. So I guess the summary would be our key values, perhaps, and these are autonomy, meaning not just independence, but rather building autonomy for the future, building structures where people can make their own decisions, building structures where our kids, the participants in our program, can begin to develop their own autonomous power in a program like this. Also, it means independence as well from NGOs, from the state, etc. It also means trust. Autonomy means that I can trust my collective members, my affinity group, and also the people that we work with, not to, for instance, rely on state structures, not to call the police, not to bring in, inspectors. We've been threatened once with health inspectors, actually, and to avoid these sorts of things. So there's autonomy. There's solidarity. Solidarity being not just solidarity with our friends in the dump, but also solidarity against the forces that have brought them to that position in the first place. So that means that we are connected to the anti-fascist struggle. We're connected to anarchists, even though the organization itself doesn't identify as anarchist. And then there's also equality. And this, of course, is not the liberal idea of equality where everybody gets the same thing, but rather an equality that destroys the bases of inequality, that, for instance, allows us to provide, if we can, safe spaces for instance, we've been experimenting with this idea of a girls' club where the girls from the settlement can come and have their own space and their own time and not have to worry about the, underwriting power relations of gender that pervade all social life. So working against inequality is part of this. So solidarity, autonomy, and equality really is the basis of this program.
Definitely. It's interesting to almost talk about failures in a context like this, because I think that I don't know the situation so far in Belgrade, but if it's anything like it is here, I think that projects like these aren't given any kind of roadmap. And anarchists in the States, I think, are in this really interesting and sort of brutal situation where we're sort of divorced from our own history in a way, because we don't have much, if any, like intergenerationality within anarchism. And we have like books we can read for sure, but we don't really have people to talk to who have been doing anarchism for 50 years, 70 years or anything like that. With a few exceptions, right? For sure. I don't want to like...
Yeah, it depends on what city too, in a lot of cases.
Certainly. Yeah. Would you say, I mean, and that's what's really exciting to me about, one of the things that's really exciting to me about this is that it is an autonomous youth collective, and it's not specifically anarchist, but I don't think things have to be specifically anarchist in order to be exciting to anarchists, you know?
Absolutely. And I can only add to that by saying that there was a time in this program when I was really diligently circling all my A's, and a lot of that had to do with the other people that we had to share this general squatted space with. It was a mixed, ideologically mixed space, and we came into a lot of conflict, and even inside our program there was conflict. And at that time, yeah, I was very, very, another anarchist comrade of mine called me the commissar for a while and to tell me to like cut it out and relax. But as we kind of reformed our program, perhaps a little too late, actually, in some cases, around these ideals that I mentioned, that desire kind of ceased. And now I find that anarchism does kind of feel more like a practice and less like a set of theories. And that to me also means that it doesn't have to be a circle A. It can also just say autonomy, as long as we know what that autonomy means, as long as that autonomy is specific. So, yeah, I think this also means that you mentioned generations, yeah? And that's true. Like, I don't know. I have some ideas about who came before me. And also, as a newcomer to the scene, like, I also kind of feel like I'm new, and the people that were already there were sort of the generation before me. But really, we're all the same basic age and general background. And not to mention, I mean, broadly speaking, race, educational attainment, and so forth. But that said, it's become easier for me now to find generational connections in these principles, in the unity of solidarity and equality and autonomy. And that's opened up a lot of doors for the whole collective, and for me especially. And also to find these values, and to find these values with the kids that we work with, you know, to find that we haven't been in a position or have had any real strong desire to sit and lecture, you know, and tell this is what anarchism is, this is what we're doing, because even within us, we don't all identify as anarchists, you know. But it has been really fun to discover these principles in new ways through the expressions of our children working together and working with the project and becoming more invested in the project. And we've seen these values come out in places we did never expect, you know.
I'm curious about, because you mentioned that Coco Lepo began as a kindergarten.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about what kind of, is there for kids like a state sanctioned education program that is mandatory? Is it yeah. kind of analogous to how it is here?
Yes. I'm not sure how many years it's been so. I want to say that it's maybe 7 or 8 years that they've had mandatory kindergarten. I could be wrong about that. But yeah, it is mandatory, which, you know, also opens up an interesting new route for abusing, you know, families that don't have access to it, right? Your kid is supposed to go. You're obligated to send him there. But if you find no way to do that, you know, the hammer can always come down on you. That said, a lot of when we did kindergarten, I guess one of the contradictions was that we, of course, reviled the existing school system. You know, we didn't want to support it, but also we couldn't offer the things that the state school system could offer, which I mean specifically documents, you know, like a documented lineage from one program to another. But we could offer skills, and that's what we did. So the kindergarten was focused a lot on the assumption that our kids would pass through our program and into the state program. And then when they got to that state program, they'd already know, for instance, letters and numbers and colors and blah, 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 which would put them, if not at equal standing, perhaps even a little above the like white kids around them, you know. And that was part of the program's idea. And in fact, I'm happy to say that reports that came back from teachers to parents to us seemed to support that. And the kids that did make it into the state school seem to be enjoying themselves, you know, which maybe didn't seem to be true before we got there. But of course, like, you know, the longer we stay, the more secrets we discover. So it could have been true before we got there, and we just don't know. But it seems like these skills really did work out. So hard to draw a causal relationship, though, you know.
I was wondering if you would talk a bit more about the dump, or sure. the so-called dump, I guess.
Yeah.
Did I understand you correctly before that it's a place where Roma people live and also, like, historically has been a space for maybe so-called political dissidents?
No. It's I tend, so far in the States on this tour, just as far as terminology goes, I've tended to sort of combine the word Roma and Gypsy together because each one lacks something the other carries. For instance, Roma is an ethnic identity that has a lot to do with political projects of nation building, although not exclusively so. Roma is also a word around which many people can come together, but because they're all coming together, there's usually a few people there waiting for them to speak in their name, you know. So Roma has the quality of bringing people together, but also the danger of falling into representational politics. Gypsy, on the other hand, is almost always a racist slur. However, it's often used in the settlement, in a positive way, also in a negative way, depending on the context. And Gypsy is also, because it has this racial dimension to it, it also makes it easier to talk about racism when I use the word Gypsy as opposed to Roma. So just as a note to the listeners, when I say Roma Gypsy, this is why. But we can say Roma or Gypsy. For me, it's okay. So in the settlement, it is, as I understand it, almost entirely Roma. If you talk to the guy that has been there the longest, he's kind of a suspicious fella in a lot of ways. He'll tell you that it is completely Roma, but he also gets a lot of support from Roma NGOs, so who knows. And the original generation, as I understand it, were mostly itinerant laborers who were assumed by the Tito-led socialist government of Yugoslavia to be the perfect migrant workers because they were somehow culturally nomadic, you know, instead of looking at them as like constantly exiled, you know. So they became like ideal migrant laborers. So they would be moved back and forth between, for instance, Kosovo and Belgrade. And then when they got to Belgrade, they would stay in these houses that their families had built. And this would grow into a permanent settlement. And then the second part is, as I said before, the part that was brought in from the Kosovo Wars. Yeah, and these are the newcomers. They have less ties to the city. They tend, supposedly, in the literature, seems to support this too. There's tension between the old groups and the new groups. So Kokolepo originally worked only with the refugee section and didn't work with the lower section. And now the youth program has combined both, the effects of which are still being discovered and debated.
And you said that you're not so familiar with like populations or anything like that, but it is located on some sort of like a garbage dump or something like
that? There's a couple construction firms that use the area. They appear to produce construction materials. There's also some longstanding relationship between these firms and the older part of the settlement. One of our collective members reported that he was told by some guard out there that this relationship had deteriorated quite rapidly since the late 90s. So there's that. And then there's the dump part. And it's really never been clear to me if it's an official dumping zone or not. And I think that that might not be entirely my fault. I think that is also partly because of how the post-socialist Serbia views property and sometimes doesn't really know what to do with it. So yeah, it's covered in garbage. But the reason why people live there is because the primary job of most of our families in the dump is collecting. They're informal urban collectors, which means they collect recyclables from dumpsters or the street or wherever they can find them. And then they keep them in a giant bin as long as they can afford that bin. And then they sell it to firms which come by and purchase it from them. And so you can't keep bins full of trash in the city. And what's worse is when these informal settlements are being evicted and demolished, the people in them get sent to these container camps, shipping container camps, where the families are sort of subdivided kind of unnaturally, and they're also disallowed from collecting. So the ability to collect, even though it isn't a job that people like, and it takes all day, it's a dawn to dusk kind of job, it still can only really happen in a few places, and they have to be half invisible. So the dump is kind of a perfect place for this to happen, no matter the living conditions there.
So for listeners who are unfamiliar generally, would you speak a bit about the like political climate in Belgrade, any history which is important to Kokolepo or anarchists or like people who circle their autonomy A's in general, or and the situation for politically left or anarchists today?
Yeah, definitely. It's a big question. I thought about it a lot last night. I'll try to keep it quite short. I was writing down some ideas last night about this question, and it struck me that when I was trying to write about the political climate in Serbia, I sort of started to accidentally write about the political climate in the United States. And I began to notice some parallels. And one of these parallels is this simultaneous addiction to authoritarianism, yet strong feelings of independence, you know, this paradox, which I think is embodied mostly by this like Trump guy, you know, like this idea, like he's there, he's a strong man. People are trying to see him to like power through the political miasma that we're all in, but still somehow he represents freedom, you know? And here's a guy that's openly talking about walls and prisons, and here people are looking at him as the harbinger of independence, you know? And this should be a contradiction. You find this also in Serbia. That said, I mean, I'm talking, when I say political climate, I'm mostly talking about like the true believers. You know, most people are extremely disaffected by the political scene. Corruption is assumed. It's expected. My English students there, when I ask them to list who they think the highest paid people in society are, and this isn't even a joke, they all list politician at number one, like over CEO, over lawyer, over everything. So, and it's not an accident. So like, for instance, there's this guy named Sheshe who was recently exonerated for war crimes by The Hague, and he's sort of their Trump. And he's even said things like, if Trump gets elected, then he and Putin together will bring world peace, you know. So there's that. Currently, the Serbian Progressive Party is in power, led by this guy Vucic, and you know, progressive here is a misnomer. They're actually quite conservative. They tend to be somewhere in between, like pro EU and pro Kosovo, which not to localize it too much for your listeners, but this basically means somebody that's trying to pander to the populist right and pander to the liberal elements as well at the same time. He's got supposedly quite a lot of media control, and so that's now the current leadership there. Yugo nostalgia is a strange thing about Serbia. So Serbia, of course, used to be one of the nations of Yugoslavia. About five wars ended up breaking Yugoslavia into its various countries. And Hugo nostalgia is a very present thing as well. But it's never been clear to me if this means like people are thinking about the good old days of socialism, or are they thinking about when Belgrade was the great capital of the non-aligned world? It's not really clear to me, but you hear a lot of this kind of unico nostalgic elements in people's political speech as well. And finally, I think the most pressing large-scale political issue at the moment is this gigantic development called Belgrade Waterfront, which has been very shifty, very shady. And the city government has, as I understand it, used public money to create this space whereby a Dubai development firm will build this shiny new commercial city with a new skyscraper and everything. I was doing some math today in the car, and it's supposed to take up something like 444 acres of the city. It'll include the largest shopping mall in the Balkans. So the resistance against this, oh, and it gets worse, like masked men have been going through, like tying people up, tying up security guards of empty properties, and then bulldozers have been knocking them over in the middle of the night.
Oh my God.
Totally insane stuff here. So the resistance against this is under the banner, Don't Drown Belgrade. And just today, I was hearing from my comrades there that a protest against this development has amassed 10,000 people at least, which is really great for Belgrade. And these are 10,000 people using the language of anti-gentrification and using the language of accountability. And so there's something to this. And on the other hand, you have the rise of new highly nationalist neo-Nazi and neo-fascist groups, of which there are many, and they appear to be multiplying. The newest on the block being the, I believe it's called the National Serbian Front, or maybe Nationalist Serbian Front. These include people that have just returned from Ukraine fighting Russians, supposedly. So they have these ideas of kind of this autonomous Ukrainian nationalism, I think, somewhere in there. But more importantly, they're running their program a lot like the British National Party ran it, where they're doing like street actions and also political actions. A couple of their members are now in jail because they attacked some comrades of ours. And so they're kind of the new kids on the block. There's also a group called Serbian Action, which might be one of the more successful sort of neo-Nazi groups. Serbian Action kind of identifies with the people that were responsible for the Nazi occupation in Serbia. These guys are, their names are like Ljotic, and this dude Nedic was the Quisling leader then at the time. They look for his sort of political rehabilitation. They have a lot to say about Roma, a lot to say about Jews and queers, etc. They're very aggressive. They're very loud. They claim that, for instance, like the Srebrenica massacres during the wars were a Western fabrication, and that General Mladic is like the hero of Serbia, this kind of stuff. And they've even written documents and circulated them publicly calling for people to attack Roma settlements and stuff like this. And they're quite prominent. And then there's also like these sort of Christian right-wing organizations that are, they run on sort of internal dictatorial powers. Like there's this group called Dveri. They are led by this guy that he runs it kind of like his own little private kingdom, this party. It started as a right-wing youth group, I believe, and they called for like a 100-year ban on gay pride, calling gay pride itself some kind of a foreign, destructive, totalitarian ideology. And the weirdest one for me is the 1389 movement. This is like a far-right movement that identifies itself as anti-fascist. They identify themselves as promoting social justice. These are like basically quotes from them. They're devoted to eliminating corruption in the Serbian political system. They're all about like local economies, and they are basically neo-Nazis. You know, this is the political climate, I guess.
I imagine also, I mean, with Coco Lepo as well, I imagine that with all of the rises of, you know, fascism and far-right activity, have you seen any kind of, has the resistance to that been equal to it?
It's an interesting question, and I think we won't have an answer for a while. It's hard to say. I can say that right now there are several projects in Belgrade which promote either anarchistic, anti-fascist sort of values, or generally speaking, like anti-authoritarian values. There's also like more authoritarian leftist groups as well, and these are openly anti-fascistic. But so far, most of the groups that I mentioned to you are they prefer to work in the political sphere. Like they're not really necessarily attacking Roma settlements in large groups like they are maybe in Bulgaria, but they're out there and they're participating in the climate. And And it shows in my English students and the way they talk about issues. They talk about them at least through this sort of vague filter that these guys have helped create over the last 10 years or so. But as far as the anarchist goes, maybe I can say, there is some history in Serbia that I'm not totally equipped to talk about, but there was anarcho-syndicalists working in Belgrade as early as, I think, 1905 or something. There were local anarchist papers being produced in Belgrade about, you know, over 100 years ago. And there's something there that, you know, that there is a history there locally. Apart from that, throughout Tito's, like, market socialist experiment, I guess, I don't know much about if there was much of an anarchist movement at that point. But then in the 90s, you had this sort of rise of anarchism again. And there were a few spaces. There was a space called Stani Pani. There was a space called Krš, which wasn't necessarily anarchist, but had a lot of anarchist politics. And then finally, there was Enix Film, which I think started in 2011. And we just recently lost the space. There's existing groups that are maybe interesting to follow. Might be there's the Budavesnik Publishing Company. They produce a lot of anarchist texts, mostly in the Serbian language. There's one of my collectives is called InfoShop Furia. This used to be in the Enix Film Squat, and now it's kind of homeless, and we're just kind of doing events now and then. There was anti-fascist booking companies called Cherry 76 and Destroy Babylon, and they were bringing all sorts of like international punk acts in, and it was really great. They still are. There's now they have to go to commercial spaces instead of the squat. There's like anti-fascist circus kind of stuff going on. And of course, there's Koko Lepo, our group. There's No Border Serbia. There's a recent sort of practice of refugee hostel creating, which involves like sort of more or less temporary squats that can be used as temporary roofs because the Balkan route brings a lot of refugees to Serbia, you know. So that's kind of the resistance. And on top of that, you have the Don't Drown Belgrade campaign, which I think could end up proving to be a boon, like that could support these sorts of anti-fascist, anti-state politics, but we'll have to see.
Definitely. That's a lot of projects.
I mean, they're small, you know, but they haven't gotten smaller. So that's something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how do you measure success? You know, yeah, exactly. Maybe I'm a broken record, but how do you measure success in a way? You mentioned refugees, and I'd really love to talk about refugee solidarity in Belgrade and also how, maybe this is a really huge question, but how refugee solidarity kind of overlaps and is informed by solidarity with Roma folks or Roma gypsies. Yeah. If you care to talk about any of the history involved that you think is relevant, or
I could, yeah. In fact, we did one event so far, only one, where we had our friends in the settlements that were kind of part of the expanding youth program to a cooking event in the city. And we made some, you know, salads and stuff for the people in the park. And this went really, really well, actually. So we were able to sort of form a circle. People were asked, like, okay, do you know why we're here? Somebody said, yeah, we're supporting the Syrians, etc. And there was a little brief discussion about what it meant to be a refugee. And then we went to this NGO space and we cooked. And we finished the salad, but we weren't, like, the other crew wasn't ready yet to, like, bring the food into the park, you know? So, and our kids were, like, really upset about this or something. You know, we want to go. We want to bring the food to the Syrians. And so there was some understanding, some vague reflections on, like, the refugee histories also in the dump itself. But I don't know, the two things, they mesh only in the sense that the people involved in both projects, you know, mesh. Koko Lepo certainly could continue to do things like this, I'm sure, and probably will. But I feel like at the moment, these struggles are being carried out on multiple fronts and not necessarily melding together. But I guess our experience fumbling through Koko Lepo, sort of clumsily approaching something like solidarity, has certainly helped the people that are coming from Koko Lepo who are integrating to the refugee struggle manage expectations and, you know, keep themselves, we'll say, mentally in shape, you know, not overexert themselves. I mean, some of our friends there who do No Border work really push themselves to their absolute limits, and it's really impressive to see, but, you know, you can't burn a candle on both ends, you know. So I think some of the things that we've learned had a lot to do with how to manage expectations and dealing with these sorts of crises. But again, you know, this is one of the projects, and we're definitely focused on Koko Lepo.
And historically, has there been a lot of solidarity with Roma people from, like, folks on the far left in Belgrade?
Rhetorically, sure. Okay. I mean, rhetorically, they're all about solidarity, you know, and I think I could say that at the beginning of the project, we were also rhetorically all about it. And I think we didn't really realize what that meant to be in solidarity until way later in the game. And we're only now really coming to terms with what real solidarity looks like, with what mutual aid looks like, how to like overcome charitable relations and grow into something that's a common project. And this has been a constant discussion. That said, our project, Coco Lepo, has received an enormous amount of support as, I guess, an expression of that sentiment, right? So that sentiment surely existed forever, but now that that sentiment is made more concrete, I think through Coco Lepo, it's become very easy for us to link with other comrades and for people to come into our space, you know, and maybe learn about our collective and perhaps join it and start working on the program. So I think that Roma issues have long been a topic of the left in Serbia, but I think now that Coco Lepo's here, there's like real chances to integrate the struggle together.
What are, first of all, like what are the ages of the people who work with Coco Lepo, it being a youth solidarity movement?
Sure. We can say like base working group, which is mostly people who are not from the settlement, with very few exceptions. This base working group, kind of, I don't know how many people at the moment, I'd say like 8 or 9. It's usually caps out at 12 and then drops again over history, are between the ages of 21-ish, 20-ish, and 30, I don't know, 5-ish. And our efforts lately have been to sort of decentralize the decision-making as best as we can and sort of help to set up structures that the kids can use to take over certain responsibilities themselves. So the question now, like who is in the collective and who is not in the collective, has increasingly become a confusing question. And that's a good thing. You know, in the past, it was always extremely clear, like this group is the collective, like these white people here are the collective, these Roma gypsies over here are the clients. And that wasn't something we said out loud. It's something that we denied most of the time, but it was definitely true at the time. And then over the course of a lot of struggles and a lot of failures and confusions, I think we've finally started to even that out really significantly and become a mutual aid project where we're sharing a project together with the kids instead of for the kids. And that's been a huge shift. So yeah, who is the collective and what are our ages? At the moment, I could say anywhere between 7 and 40, you know.
That's awesome. I remember reading in the write-up that's being passed around for your tour right now, that one of the topics that you'll discuss is, and this isn't the correct rhetoric in the write-up, but solidarity, not charity or whatever, which is sort of politically loaded.
I think mutual aid, not charity.
Charity, yeah. And I was curious about that and curious about some ruminations that you have about like what actual solidarity really looks like. And solidarity almost is a somewhat politically polluted word, perhaps, if one is using it in a funny way or something. But yeah. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, on the word itself. Yeah, of course, all the words that we use run the risk of being co-opted and polluted. And I think this is why it's important to really struggle for these ideals behind the words and make them as visible as humanly possible. And I'll never give solidarity to the trots. You know, I mean, this is a word that really means something to us. So, yeah, what solidarity has come to mean is, yes, being with somebody, but being with somebody against something else and having vague ideas about what that thing you're against is kind of shapes the project, we've noticed, and shapes our discussions together. And so we're not getting together with the kids and talking about capitalism, but we are getting together and saying, listen, when you don't let Samira speak, how do you think that makes her feel? You know, can we give her some space now to speak? And creating solidarity that denies essentially normal cultural values and training. This is what we've been working on with the kids directly, between each other. Okay, like in the group of adults, yeah, our discussions are, you know, really cerebral and theoretical, and we're, you know, banging out ideas constantly. But at the end of the day, and somebody in the meeting is always there to remind us, like, we've got to take this to practice at some point. You know, this has got to translate into our actions. And it's been mostly from our actions that we've been fixing our ideas about what solidarity means. So really, solidarity is showing respect and sharing a project, not just with something, but against something else. That's how I see it.
Are there any projects that Coco Lepo is doing right now that you find particularly exciting or challenging?
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the most exciting developments recently was One of our collective members had the brilliant idea to go and have a meeting that is just the kids, basically. So to go and say, like, we're going to the settlement. Today, we're not going to go play sports or do theater activities. We're going to go have a meeting. And the most of the boys were like, I don't want to do that. You mean like no sports at all, like nothing? And we're like, no, we're going to go and we're going to plan the next events. We're going to talk about what this program is. We're going to, you know, we're going to organize together. And the boys were like, I think I'm just going to stay home, you know, and the girls are like, yo, I'll come. And so we ended up with, I don't know, 7 or 8 girls between the ages of, I want to say 8 and maybe 12. Who showed up, and then they took meeting notes and they set the agendas and we facilitated, you know, we said like, okay, usually we take notes, like who can do that? And somebody would do that. All right, here's some information about our budget, you know, and we'd talk about the budget, and here's some information. Somebody had some concerns about one of the older collective members. Like, we should talk about these concerns, you know, like why does this person make you uncomfortable? What can we do about that? So we worked on making sure people had spaces to speak. We didn't like say, hey, we're going to do this by consensus, but we did kind of wait for anything that would sort of indicate that it would happen otherwise, but nothing ever indicated that. So there was a very kind of natural understanding that these things worked in this, you know, terms of equality and consensus. And it was great. Like that was really exciting, you know, to see not only do these kids have the capacity for organizing, but they're actually genuinely good at it and have an interest in it. So that was one thing. Other things kind of down the pipeline that are exciting are our next space. You know, we lost the squat, so we had to stop the kindergarten, and it became a youth program exclusively after that. But we're looking at new spaces now and the possibility of taking a space with our kids, you know, and not instead of, as the old way, having the kids kind of move into the space we already had. But taking a space with the kids is going to, I think that's going to change a lot of our dynamic. And I'm really excited about that.
That's really cool. That's really fantastic.
Knock on wood.
I know, right? So with this Belgrade Waterfront development project, which is, to me, what it sounds like is this just diabolical new-ish trend in capitalism, which is just like brutal, brutal bougification and development of stuff. I imagine that the squatting scene in Belgrade is perhaps a bit more challenging. Is that true? And would you talk about the squatting scene in Belgrade a little bit?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about what I know. Enex Film, for instance, was the major squat in Belgrade that had like a social or cultural value to it. Besides Enex, there is some kind of a sort of, we'll say, low-level popular tradition of squatting, but this is like squatting to live, and most of this happened during the transition into sort of neoliberal market, when properties just sort of went wild, and you could find a space and take it, and then hope that somebody will give it to you eventually. So, I mean, you know, my partner's grandmother got her apartment like that, you know, and it's not so uncommon. But as far as like social and cultural spaces goes, at the moment, as I understand it, there might be up to 3 squats at the moment in Belgrade. However, one of them are maybe some people that we didn't really get along with at our squat, and they formed like an exclusively cultural space, and, you know, all the best luck to them, I guess. And then another space is some people that we don't really know very well, but they've taken a space on the Sava, and we're not sure what they're using it for yet. But like our group found itself kind of left behind in a weird way, and it's our own fault. You know, we're still figuring out what we want to do even with each other at the moment. In a new space, but our space, no matter what it will be or how many it will be, is going to be a political space, and that's something that Belgrade right now does not seem to have. So that's the next step, I think. There was a squatted theater, though, that was also kind of a half political, half cultural effort, and it still exists, as I understand it. A movie theater, I mean. Mm-hmm. And they basically got away with it, kind of banking on this sort of, again, Yuga nostalgic trend that had a lot to do with how people used to see the cinema, you know, and what happened to the cinema when the capitalists took over and stuff. So, yeah, squatting has some history there. And
I guess it's never easy, but maybe I don't want to ask this question. I was going to ask, like, what are the mechanics of cracking a squat or something? Which is like, I know in, and I'm probably going to cut this out, but I know in certain European countries, it's just like you basically go in and you do some research on the landlord, and then you call the squatters council, and then they all mob up. And if you're in there for 24 hours, you essentially like own the space, which is from an American context,
Sounds awesome.
It sounds incredible, yeah. actually. Yeah. But I was wondering if there was like squatting laws that were easy to work around in Belgrade or anything.
I'm probably the wrong person to ask. But in general, my understanding is that squats still lack any legal character at all. So there's not the law has not yet accounted for the possibilities of squatting in a consistent way. So there isn't a way for you to squat and take the building. But there also might not be ways for you to get kicked out exactly yet either. Like, nobody's really sure. So I can say that property law in Serbia is in its infancy still and makes for some interesting opportunities, but also a lot of uncertainty.
And will you talk a bit about some international efforts for mutual aid or solidarity with Koko Lepo?
Definitely, yeah. Without the international anarchist, anti-fascist, and sort of punk and hardcore scenes, it would be very difficult to have gotten as far as we've gotten. And a lot of support came from punk acts coming from Germany, punk acts in Serbia. Enix Film itself, I mean, like Cherry 76, the anti-fascist bookers I mentioned, helping us bring in groups that felt solidarity to our projects that would somehow often donate their own money that they would get from shows to the project. Sometimes they would be traveling Europe on tour and load up a van with stuff, and they would come to play in Belgrade and unload all this stuff into the kindergarten, you know. And not only that, but we've toured a lot internationally in Europe. This is the first time, I think. We had an event in America once before in Pittsburgh, but this is the first kind of tour. Yeah, so an international support also doesn't just mean these material elements, but it also means like sharing these struggles and especially of the failures that we've all had with spaces and also trying to integrate ourselves into the lived struggles of people. And I feel like on this tour especially, I've been really happy to say that apart from material support, these challenges that have been brought to me have really emphasized the international character of really not only just mutual aid efforts, but I kind of like anarchism in general, maybe that kind of small A kind of anarchism. Yeah, so this is for sure, I think Koko Lepo from the beginning had an international character to it, and that continues today and it will continue, hopefully, indefinitely.
So, hello, dear listeners. Due to a very unfortunate technical error, we have lost the remaining 13 or so minutes of this interview. Many, many apologies both to you and to our guest. Just to give you a broad picture of what we talked about, we touched a bit more on the complex nature of actual solidarity and made the point that sometimes so-called real solidarity can look somewhat ordinary or boring sometimes. We also spoke more about the tour that Freddie just concluded with a stop in Asheville and about the challenges that the various audiences brought to the talks he did, in particular concerning the question of race, racism, and the ally complex. Our guest brought up the point that there have been various conversations about this topic in the U.S. that have not happened or have not happened in the same way as they have in Belgrade. He was particularly excited to engage with American audiences about this issue and said a lot of really cool and poignant things, which we are unfortunately unable to share with you. Again, many apologies. Though if you would like to write to this project, you can email them at kokolepo@riseup.net. That's KOKOLEPO. And you can also get in touch with them on Fedbook by searching Koko Lepo AV. Again, that's KOKOLEPO. However, all of this perhaps gives us the opportunity to share more in depth than we may originally have been able to some of the musical projects that our guest recommended. It also bears mentioning that mutual aid in the form of money donations most often happens for this project in the form of music shows, punk, metal, hardcore, or other varieties. If you feel so moved to, please feel free to make a solidarity show in your town. Again, you can contact this project by writing to kokolepo@riseup.net. And as we say in part of the recovered audio, for your next awesome vacation, consider Belgrade. And now for some music. The first project which you're hearing right now is a Roma language hip-hop project called Lord Castro with Jelim Jelim. The next track is one from a hardcore project called Katma, the singer of which is one of the co-founders of the kindergarten. The third is another track from Gypsy Mafia, an Antifa Roma hip-hop group A track from which opened up the show as well, with Avakari.
Dromesa, messi jedu v srpsko nočno mora Sobori no peba šoromajte Amaro, ani to ame Na fermino, čako rako ambuno Se osveto na tiho, koju pravu Amaro, ona postoji no Srpski dan Roma, po više puti stavine Ne pojek stranka zbori ne Ani ko na tiho, očo roni te Svako lako Roma, načavo bokalo Mere, il mame kakio ovel Ne da ba Roma, samo preče peperona Psihoza, dramatika, bari Problematika, na vladina organizacija Den
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. Reci avakari, dođi na čas.